In 2008, longtime journalist and U.S. News reporter David Whitman wrote a provocatively titled book, Sweating the Small Stuff, Inner City Schools and the New Paternalism. His use of the word paternalism sparked a raucous debate among education reformers and reform critics about no-excuses schools like KIPP, Amistad Academy, and Cristo Rey. Were these schools to be celebrated for their prescriptiveness over matters of student behavior and character? Or should they be criticized as racist, classist institutions, not unlike the old boarding schools for American Indian children? We talk with David about the book, the schools he profiled, and the still brewing debate about the meaning of the new paternalism. Join us for today's edition of the Education Next Book Club. David Whitman, welcome to the Education Next Book Club.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Now, David, this is a little bit of a homecoming now because, of course, proud that at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, where I have my day job, we were the publisher of this book and enjoyed working with you on this several years ago. When did Sweating the Small Stuff come out? This was, 2000?
It came out in 2008.
2008.
In the summer of 2008, and then there was a sort of second printing that came out in 2009.
Yeah. Now, as I explained in the introduction, you are a longtime journalist and author, but now a speechwriter for Secretary Arne Duncan. We're not going to talk too much about that, but we're going to focus on the book, but I will be curious about your thoughts about how things have changed since 2008 as this debate over urban schools and what is possible in terms of closing the achievement gap has continued, and if anything, has really ramped up recently. Well, let's start with the book. You dive in and talk about a little bit of historical background on what's happened with school reform to date and about the achievement gap. But what's probably most provocative about the book is your use of the term paternalism. So let's dive right into that. First of all, the big picture on paternalism before we get to how it's applied to schools. When you did research on sort of old paternalism and new paternalism, what did you find? What do you mean by the new paternalism?
What I meant by the new paternalism was that I was referring to a kind of benevolent paternalism. I don't think the idea of being paternalistic would work in a school setting if there wasn't also a strong sense of connection between the teachers and the students. The students need to know that the teachers, their principal, really cares very deeply about them. And I described this difference as the difference between the old paternalism and the new paternalism, or the malevolent paternalism, and the benevolent paternalism, or the benign paternalism. The old paternalism was kind of widely discredited, particularly in educational settings, by the American boarding schools, for boarding schools that were used for American Indians. They were really out to destroy the culture and the civilization of Native Americans, and that's not at all the case with these new schools that I describe as being practicing a kind of benign paternalism. They are very prescriptive, and that was the key distinctive feature that led me to talk about the fact that they were paternalistic. They were very prescriptive, and they also were very much about, not just about high achievement, but about character. They were very concerned about kind of molding the character traits that were going to help students succeed once they left the school as well. So there's a lot of differences, I think, between the old paternalism and the new paternalism.
And you explain that this term, new paternalism, is not yours that you coined. This is something that's been kicked around in some scholarly debates. What tell us more about that. What's the basic ideas behind this new paternalism? And how does it apply in other social sectors?
Well, there was an entire volume written on the new paternalism that came out actually from the Brookings Institution in 1996, a little more than a decade before this book came out. Unfortunately, most people who read the book and responded to it had no idea that there was a long history of talking about the new paternalism. The new paternalism initially was really referred to in the context of welfare reform and welfare programs. There was a backlash against the idea of just simply handing out aid to recipients and asking for very little in return. And so the new paternalism evolved where there were not only work requirements, but they were people were being urged to look for job. They were urged to get into job training, and aid became in some form somewhat conditional. You had to do certain things to get the aid rather than just receive it without any strings attached.
And not just do certain things, but in some ways behave in certain ways.
That's correct.
Right? I mean, really trying to change the behavior of low-income families.
That's correct.
And this strikes a lot of people as saying, oh, this sounds racist, this sounds classist. You're trying to, so, I mean, that is the old rub about paternalism, right? Is that this is an attempt by well-educated, mostly white, mostly wealthy people to try to change the behavior of people who are poor, and that, some are on the left would argue that this is inherently racist and classist.
Well, there are a number of followers of Paulo Freire who have made that kind of case since the book came out. I just reject it categorically. There's nothing about any of these schools that I think of as being racist or classist. There's an intense connection with the students, an intense concern for helping elevate their educational attainment and their achievement. These are teachers and school leaders who leave their cell phone on for hours, who talk to students late at night about assignments, who become very much a part of their students' lives. The reason I tell you the whole phrase paternalism kicked off more of a storm that I knew it was going to be somewhat controversial, but it kicked off more of a storm than I anticipated. Mm-hmm. And for some of the reasons you said. And when the book came out, Jay Matthews at the Washington Post wrote a review that basically said this is an excellent book, but I can't stand the term paternalism, and we should have a naming contest to rename these schools. And he proposed this contest, and a lot of people submitted entries, and they ended up with No Excuses Schools, which was also a term that was used in the book fairly regularly, and it was also a term that had been used previously. In my view, that term doesn't quite capture what's going on at these schools. They're not just, kind of zero-tolerance schools. There are schools that are very prescriptive about how students behave and about how they comport themselves in class. And that reluctance, that unwillingness to acknowledge the prescriptive aspects of these schools, I found there was an element of kind of political correctness in that. Mm-hmm. It was fascinating that Jay would have had no problems with labeling the schools maternalistic. Mm-hmm. It was really the idea that there was a fatherly prescriptive presence, mm-hmm, that was the troubling part.
Yeah, fascinating. So, and part of the idea behind these paternalistic schools, or a big part, is that if they could prescribe the behavior that students are modeled and their academic performance, that then they would be able to more easily enter the middle class once they go to college and onward, that they would break down the barriers between growing up in poverty and being able to access the more general middle class American workforce and society. I mean, do we have reason to believe, though, that that's necessarily true? I mean, how do we know that these schools actually are equipping kids to make that kind of switch from what could be very different kinds of communities?
Well, we didn't. At the time I wrote the book, the evidence on that point was kind of limited because a lot of these students had not been followed into college and weren't seeing how they were succeeding after they left the embrace of their institutions. We're now starting to get some evidence, and it's pretty encouraging. It doesn't mean that it's no magical solution. It's not a silver bullet, but the rates of retention in college, the persistence in college, the graduation in college is all considerably higher, given that these students come from low-income backgrounds, typically single-parent families. than it is in their peers who don't go to these schools.
Yeah. Now, some have argued, and I have, you know, I understand this argument that says, look, these schools are schools that are 100% poor kids, 100% minority, and they're trying to teach the kids how to be more like middle class adults. Another way to do this would be to have schools that are integrated racially, socioeconomically, and then students could learn middle class mores from their peers. You know, why do you think there's been so much support in education reform for trying to fix high poverty schools rather than try to say, hey, how can we continue the you know, the mission of school integration so that these schools aren't so segregated to begin with? In other words, that you have celebrated in the book what are essentially segregated schools.
Well, many of these students were attending schools that were of a similar socioeconomic demographic comparison. So I'm not sure that they are making an existing problem worse. The charge that you hear most often against these schools is that they are creaming students and that they are not really treating the truly disadvantaged students. And I think that's also a charge that is pretty well rebutted in the book. Mm-hmm. You know, there was one great educational experiment with new paternalism that I missed when I wrote this book. And that is HBCUs, historically black colleges and universities. And HBCUs have always had this core insight from the time they were first started being established at the turn of the century, a century ago, that they were not going to have the kind of financial resources and academic resources that their white counterparts did have. But one of the ways they could help accelerate educational attainment among their students was to put a particularly strong emphasis on character development. And it was all about these kind of non-cognitive traits that are prized in the labor market, about persistence, about discipline, about politeness. And so if you go back and read Booker T. Washington and W.B. Du Bois writing about the early establishment of HBCUs, they were extremely concerned. They were described as black Puritans, and they were extremely concerned about developing these non-cognitive traits and characters, skills. And they've had a pretty remarkable record given the very meager resources that they've worked with over the years. So I don't see this tradition as being inconsistent at all with a very robust tradition in the African American community. W.B. Du Bois once wrote that he attended both Harvard and Fisk, and he said at Fisk they drummed the issue of the content of your character into you, and at Harvard nobody paid any attention to whatsoever.
Fascinating. Okay, we're talking with David Whitman, the author of Sweating the Small Stuff, Inner City Schools and the New Paternalism. We'll be right back after this short break.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Sweating the Small Stuff. David, let's get into the schools themselves. You highlight, let's see, 6 schools in this book, all of them exhibiting what you call the new paternalism. Some people call them no-excuses schools. The first one that you profile is a fascinating school called the American Indian Public Charter School. I should say that there was some news on this school recently, a study done out of Cato finding that some of the highest performing charter school chains in California got the least amount of philanthropic dollars, and the school that broke the curve on that was this one, American Indian Public Charter School, that was just knocking the socks off of the test scores. Very interesting principle that you got to profile. Ben Chavis.
That's correct.
Tell us about Ben and his school.
Well, Ben is a little bit of a sort of mad dog principal, controversial in many respects, but he's run a fabulously successful school. He came into a school that was an absolute disaster. It had been established by and for American Indian students in the Oakland area. Students were given smoke breaks. They were sewing moccasins and drumming in class. Hardly any students were showing up to school. The school was about to be closed for its really terrible performance. And Ben came in and was very rigorous, very demanding, but totally turned the school around. And it was very much a kind of tough love regimen that he imposed. He started aligning the curriculum with the state standards. He got the textbooks that were aligned with the state standards. He hired teachers from kind of Ivy League schools and first-rank institutions. And he was a very active principal. He was in the classroom every day, seeing how the teachers were doing. And it's now one of the highest performing schools in the state of California.
You know, there's some fascinating stories about Ben and his relationship with the community and with the parents. He didn't have a lot of respect for parental involvement or community involvement, which seems very un-PC. What was his take on that?
Well, Ben is a walking testament to political incorrectness. But his take, and it's was shared in slightly different ways by many of the school leaders that I wrote about. His take was that the school should be responsible for educating the students when they walk in the door, and that in many cases the parents were not well equipped to support their children education, that they were perhaps single parents, perhaps the students were living with grandparents, the parents themselves may never have finished high school, they might be working at several jobs, it might be very difficult for them to come to school on a regular basis. You weren't going to be getting the kind of Secret Santa bake sale sort of involvement that you get routinely in suburban schools. And I think only one of the schools that I wrote about actually had a PTA in it. And I'd say Ben was at one extreme where he was basically saying, you know, leave the educating to us. The other school leaders were of the opinion that they wanted to encourage parental involvement and parental participation, but they weren't going to depend on it to make the school succeed. They were going to do everything they could to educate the children once they walked in the door.
Right, they really took responsibility.
Yes.
So I think I heard Ben once complain about his parents being nothing but prostitutes and drug addicts. Okay, wow. this is something you don't hear from principals every day.
Yeah. Well, I'm not sure that he would go that far, but I was there when he got an argument with one grandmother who he'd taken the cell phone away from the student during the day, and he wasn't shy about expressing his disagreement.
Okay, you also looked at Amistad Academy, the kind of flagship for what has now become the Achievement First network of schools.
Right,
Daisha Toll. Another fascinating leader. Tell us about her and her school.
Well, Daisha is also in her own way a kind of force of nature, and Rhodes Scholar, daughter of a university president, and she just recognized and came to the conclusion that education was really the civil rights issue of our generation. And so she set about, with a lot of consultation and a lot of help from a variety of sort of experts in the New Haven area, she set about finding a space for Amistad. And created an amazing school. I mean, it's just a wonderful place to visit. You know, I have to say, in general, I had been, as we've mentioned, I've been a reporter for decades before I wrote this book, and I had spent a lot of time in poor neighborhoods, in ghettos, barrios all across the country, and I had been in a lot of model programs. There were job training programs for the homeless, programs for crack addicts. I mean, I covered basically poverty and social policy for 20 years. And what was very striking about those programs was that even the best programs tended to have fairly modest impacts. They increased wages in the job training programs by 8% or 10%. They reduced poverty by 7% or whatever the exact statistics were. They were good programs, but they had fairly modest effects. What was very striking about doing the reporting for this book was that you would walk into these schools and it was just really exciting to be there, because you were really witnessing that the lives of students were being transformed. When you sat down and talked to the students, there was a dramatic before and after story that they were telling.
And how was she doing it? I mean, what was going on at Amistad that was having such a big impact?
Well, it was a lot of the same kind of practices that were found at all of these schools. A kind of rigor about curriculum, a rigor about character. They had imported some of the mnemonic devices that KIPP teachers use in the lower schools, the SLANT, which stands for sit up, listen, ask questions, nod, and T stands for track the speaker with your eyes. And students get their SLANT corrected if they're drifting off and not paying attention. They also, Amistad also provides a lot of rewards for good behavior and good conduct and high academic achievement. The first day I was there was a kind of all assembly where there were some drumming and there was some shout outs for various kids and things they had accomplished. And sometimes if a student gets in a fight or something like that, they have to stand up in front of the school and apologize for the behavior. So it's all about kind of taking ownership. It's all about not making excuses for how you perform. It's also about setting rigorous standards, both for raising achievement, but mm-hmm. also about character.
You know, critics of these schools or of school reform in general will say, well, these no-excuse of schools, they're just obsessed with test scores. They're just testing factories. You know, there's no real learning going on in them. And what would you say to those critics?
I don't think any critic has ever said that who's actually ever spent any time in these schools. It's true that there is a lot of testing that goes on in these schools, but the testing is the kind of testing that you want in schools, which is that it's used mostly for assessment purposes. So there's a lot of interim tests that are given, and the teachers want to test their students. Rather than thinking of this as a kind of drill and kill regimen, they are looking towards a test and assessment to help them figure out what students need help with, where they themselves need to improve their instruction and their practice. And so there's no dread about testing in these schools. It's seen as a positive thing that can help accelerate and improve learning.
Now, Daisha, as I recall, was not thrilled about the use of the word paternalism. What was her reaction?
Well, Daisha was she was a little more mixed about it than some other people. I think Daisha was concerned. First of all, let me just say that most of the founders and school leaders were quite liberal at these schools. If you had to put them on somewhere on the political spectrum, they would definitely be on the left of the political spectrum. That wasn't true with Ben Chavis at American Indian, but it was true of most of the other school leaders. And Daisha was certainly, I would say, on the left of the political spectrum as well. And I think her concern was the concern that a lot of the school leaders had, which was that the term was just too loaded for people to even think about. But her other concern was that, and I share this in the aftermath of the book, was that it wasn't just, as I said earlier, it wasn't just the fact that there was this kind of benevolent paternalism that made it work. What made it work was that there was this personal connection between teachers and students and between the principal and the students. And she felt, with some justification, that the importance of that connection would get lost if people started talking about the kind of benevolent paternalism.
Okay, we're here talking with David Whitman, author of Sweating the Small Stuff. We'll be back in a few.
For in-depth features, cutting-edge research, and up-to-the-minute commentary on education policy, check out educationnext.org. There you'll find blog entries, new articles published weekly, plus videos, podcasts, and more. That's educationnext.org.
Back with David Whitman, author of Sweating the Small Stuff, Inner City Schools and the New Paternalism. So David, you know, you take the reader through these phenomenal schools, very exciting stuff going on, and then in your conclusion, it's a little bit of a downer, which is that it's going to be really hard to replicate these schools at anything like scale. Why is that?
Well, I argue that it's going to be hard for a number of reasons. There's very little, I think, that you can accomplish at scale without, to some extent, having the support of the sort of tripod of the education establishment, which is the school bureaucracy, the school administration, the teachers' union, and
ed schools.
And ed schools, yes, mm-hmm. Excuse me. That are responsible for preparing teachers. And for a variety of reasons, the all of the practices of these benevolent paternalistic schools are in many ways at odds and very disorienting to all three of those sectors. In the ed schools, there's a real attachment to progressive pedagogy. The sort of core concept of it is that that you don't need to be too prescriptive about what students learn, that students will want to learn naturally, and that you just need to sort of give them opportunities and encourage the way. And these schools do reject that approach. They are not all about progressive pedagogy. A lot of the schools I wrote about, most of the schools I wrote about were charter schools, and they were non-unionized schools. I did write about one school that was a neighborhood public school, University Park campus school, that was that did have union teachers. But the school leaders at these schools have a lot of freedom that they might not have in the traditional public schools. They can have a longer school day. They can have students and teachers come in on Saturdays. They can extend the school year. They can change the block scheduling of classes. So there's a whole series of things that it would be very difficult to do district-wide with most unions. They also have a lot of autonomy, and that too is something that the school district bureaucracy would find, I think, rather difficult to handle if it was something that was done district-wide.
Yeah. This issue around curriculum is interesting. You hear people say, well, these schools work okay for poor kids, but you don't see middle-class families clamoring for these same kind of prescriptive approaches. Is that okay? I mean, can we admit that perhaps schools that are designed to serve the needs of the most disadvantaged would be overkill or not the right fit for kids from more affluent backgrounds?
Well, I was in a lot of ways a very unlikely person to write this book. I grew up in Philadelphia. I went to, I was a lifer at a Quaker school, Quaker private school, called Germantown Friends. It was, in some respects, somewhat like Sidwell Friends in Washington, D.C. And we certainly had a much more progressive form of pedagogy than took place at these schools. And it was a great school. I would point out that E.D. Hirsch, who is really the kind of godfather of the notion of a rigorous curriculum and a curriculum that's anchored in content knowledge, he also went to a progressive school. And I think he concluded, kind of like I felt, that if you had students who were kind of richly supported by their families, exposed to all sorts of cultural opportunities, in many cases who have been tested to be admitted to the school, you could probably be a little looser on the kind of the form of the pedagogy. But these students often come from neighborhoods that are not just poor, but have a high sense of disorder, and most of them are growing up on blocks where there are relatively few married families, two-parent families, high rates of unemployment, high rates of homelessness, drug abuse. It's a very different scenario than what you would face for students who are going to attend Sidwell Friends.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about what's happened since the book came out. That was in 2008, now 2011. First of all, many of these schools and their chains, their networks, have continued to expand, right? I think KIPP is up over 100 schools, I believe, or right at about 100.
KIPP's right around 100 now, yeah.
Yeah, I think Amistad now has cloned itself to something like 20 Achievement First schools. I've got a couple more seed academies, seed schools. That's something that was in the book, and the Cristo Rey network of schools continues to grow. In the policy world, though, I would say, if anything, and see if you agree, that there's been a sharper debate about the meaning of these schools. So you have a handful of schools that are showing tremendous results. Does that mean that all schools could get the same results if they just applied the same effort and principles? Or does it mean that there's just something special about the kind of kids that are being attracted to a KIPP or to an Achievement First that you can't replicate in a traditional public school? What's your take on that debate that's going on right now?
Well, this debate kind of erupted right when I was finishing my book, and it was really a debate about the power of schools to change outcomes, and it's still going on. There's sort of one side that argues that poverty is not destiny, and that schools alone can have quite a powerful impact on the life chances of disadvantaged children. There's another side to the debate that that argues that poverty is the chief influence of chief determinant of student performance, and that we have to do much more to make schools and our social service programs really a kind of support centers to provide out-of-school supports for students if they're ever going to really succeed. So that debate really exploded right when this book came out, and I kind of wandered into it sort of innocently. I think my book clearly was on the side of the debate that suggests that schools alone, a really great school, can have quite a powerful impact on the life course of a student. Run your question by me again.
Let me put this out for you. So Diane Ravitch recently has said to the effect that, you know, sure, it's like saying that because one person can run a 4-minute mile, that means you should expect everybody to be able to run a 4-minute mile. So we've got a handful of examples of schools that can get these tremendous results in student achievement. That doesn't necessarily mean that we should have a policy that expects all schools serving impoverished kids to be able to get the same incredible results in the face of poverty. Is that a fair point?
I think it is a fair point. I think it's also a fair point, though, that we could expect many more schools to do much better than they are doing now with,
right.
with severely disadvantaged students.
Yeah. So you are now busy at the Department of Education, but when you get back to life as a writer, do you have any projects in mind that you're hoping to do? How do you follow up on this, on Sweating the Small Stuff? What's the next big question to tackle?
Mike, I don't have any projects at the moment. I will say that I went into this book totally unaware of how much work it was going to be, because I had written several books beforehand, but they were fairly easy to produce, or I produced them fairly quickly. This was a very intensive piece of work, to be honest, I think it has been more theorized about than read. I'm not sure how many. When the book came out, I got interviewed by a number of reporters who had actually read the Education Next articles summarizing the book, but had never gotten a copy of the book or bothered to read it. So I'm going to put off any kind of project right for now.
And where do you see some of these debates that we've been talking about today going? Do you think that this idea that schools have to focus not just on achievement, but also on student behaviors and character. Do you see that idea gaining ground in the larger policy discussion?
I don't really see that gaining ground. And I think that's one of the important insights about these schools that has been largely overlooked in the debate about whether they are creaming students, whether they are taking the hard cases and succeeding with them or not, whether you want to call them no excuses schools. I think these schools have become sort of symbolic schools in some ways in this broader debate about how much we can expect of teachers and school leaders who are working with disadvantaged students.
Right. But we, right, much of the discussion gets boiled down to what they can achieve in terms of test scores and the methods that they use academically. But if we don't forget the non-cognitive skills, which it sounds like, the leaders going back 100 years identified, that we're really going to be missing something.
I agree, and it was interesting when I started work on this book, and even at the time I finished it, there are both a lot of conservatives and a lot of liberals for very different reasons who believe in talking about the importance of character in schools and the importance of schools developing strong character. So for the conservatives, that was a question of that they liked these schools because they promoted what they saw as the kind of traditional virtues. They promoted persistence and they promoted respectful behavior and they promoted thrift and they promoted discipline. For those on the left, they wouldn't necessarily refer to them as virtues or character skills, but they would talk about non-cognitive skills. So you had folks like Richard Rothstein, Christopher Jenks, who have also talked about the importance of developing these skills for going on and succeeding in the world.
Right, and really not just skills, but really traits, attributes,
yes.
Habits.
Yes.
Right, which is something that we're not as comfortable talking about. But it could be at the heart of what these schools are doing well.
It's certainly a big chunk of it. And it's one of the two things that really is distinctive about them, the other being the fact that they are prescriptive about how students behave themselves.
Okay. Well, great. Well, David, if you do decide to write another book, perhaps about your experience on the inside during the Obama administration, we'd be glad to have you back. Again, David Whitman, the author of Sweating the Small Stuff, Inner City Schools, and the New Paternalism. Thank you for joining us on the Education Next Book Club.
My pleasure.
Executive producer of the Education Next Book Club is Marcy Kansterman. Audio engineer is Joe Portnoy, and I'm your host, Mike Petrilli, for the Education Next Book Club.